enthusiastic over the work which yields him nothing but a bare living. But the more he dislikes his work, the more reason he has to take the necessary steps to get out of it into something he likes better. In most cases, his only hope lies in the possibilities of his free time, when he may prepare himself for the sort of work he does like, and form alliances with others who can and will aid him in getting into that sort of work. If he wastes his free time in riotous living or idleness, or in association with people who lead him into negative habits, obviously he must remain in the sort of work he does not like. I didn't like the work I was forced to do during my youth. It was hard, and it paid only enough for a bare living of the plainest sort. I got out of that sort of work by using my free time to prepare myself for something better. The preparation consisted of reading, going to school, and especially the formation of friends among a class of people who could be of use to me. It was these very friends whom I first contacted during my free time that came to my aid later in life when I needed working capital to enter the steel business. You see now why I called free time opportunity time. In a strict sense, one should have no such thing as free time, for all of one's time outside of that required for sleep should be used as to bring one some form of benefit. I can truthfully say that I never, in my entire life, spent a second of my time voluntarily with anyone whom I did not believe could not be but for him.
But, Mr. Carnegie, wouldn't some people consider it selfish for one to cultivate only those whom he desired to use?
No matter how one may view this habit, it is an essential for personal achievement. Personally, I see nothing selfish about it, provided one so relates himself to others that he gives as well as receives, and I have made it clear that I have always followed this practice. I can truthfully say, for every benefit I have ever received from another person, I have rendered that person an equivalent benefit or more. And for every dollar I have accumulated, I have helped others, many others, to accumulate. So where has the selfishness on my part come in? And to top off my career, I am now engaged in giving all my wealth to other people, in ways I think best suited to aid them.
I am glad I asked that question, for it is one that many another person will ask without an opportunity to get the correct answer, had I not asked it. From what you have said, I have reached the conclusion that the question of the value of time boils itself down to where one is forced to recognize that the most important portion of one's time is his free time, because the other periods of the day must, of necessity, remain routine periods during which one may not always have control over them.
You now have the viewpoint I wished you to get. Free time is exactly what its name implies, for it is the starting point of all individual freedom of both body and mind. There is but one thing over which anyone has greater control than he has over his free time, and that is the nature of his thoughts. And, strangely enough, one's free time is the most favorable of all times for one to organize and direct his thoughts along the lines of his own choice. It provides one with an opportunity to withdraw his thoughts from the pressing obligations of life and direct them to the source of that secret power from within which holds the answer to all human problems. Here, then, is the greatest of all reasons why one should organize his free time and make deliberate, constructive use of it instead of wasting it in association with idlers and those who lack ambition. And I conceive it to be true that the man who organizes and guards his free time by a careful choice of associates, far from being a selfish person, thereby demonstrates the utmost of unselfishness. For only in this way can a man become the greatest benefit to himself and to others. If you wish to find the really selfish man, you may find him wasting his time, time that may belong to his family or his creditors, in association with idlers who unwisely believe they are having a good time. You will find the selfish man in the saloons and the gambling dens, or in worse places, in company with those who believe that free time is something a man has a right to waste. Look around. Observe people carefully, and the truth of what I have said will become obvious. Selfish men are those who live only for self, and usually they prefer to live their lives in company with others who live for self. I hope I have set you right on this subject, for there is such misunderstanding as to what constitutes selfishness. Unselfishness manifests itself by the respect for and the constructive use of time. Selfishness manifests itself by a wanton disregard of time, one's own. No man is to himself alone. Civilization places on every man a responsibility to others in one form or another. But too many men wish to benefit by the advantages of civilization without contributing anything to the source of these advantages. That is selfishness in its most malignant form, or I have totally misinterpreted the meaning of the word selfishness. My emphasis of this subject is not intended as a rebuke to you for asking the question that prompted it, but it is intended to inspire thought on the part of those who will need straight thinking on this subject, of whom there are millions. Selfishness is one of the fundamental evils of the world, and its true nature needs analysis such as I hope I have given it.
Granted that a man makes efficient use of his work time by relating it to his free time, and so combines the two periods that he is able to procure whatever he desires, that he has a definite major purpose and by the efficient use of his time attains that purpose or is well on the way toward its attainment. Is that enough to ensure his success, Mr. Carnegie?
No. Assuming that you have reference to material things, money or its equivalent, when you speak of success, let me call that nor the actual temporary possession of it will mean much to the man who does value notion, use of time. He sets it for 2, 3, savings, which he puts to work in some form of investments, 4, charity and recreation. All 4 of these items are controlled by from urgency. This ensures the saving of a definite percentage of one's income. Could it make one, if he allowed it all to go for living expenses, or spent it for recreation, or for any other purpose that did not yield a material return of some sort? I must tell you, however, the if a man is getting $100 a month and he receives an increase of $25 a month, under ordinary circumstances he could save the entire amount of his increase, because if he could get along on $100 a month before the increase, he could get along on the same amount afterward just as well. Economic security is attained by careful management of one's income, and it calls for strict self-discipline in the matter of spending. The trouble with most Americans is that they have acquired the spending habit during their childhood because of the lack of proper self-discipline on the part of their parents, and this habit has become a sort of mania with them. The habit of saving carries with it just as great a thrill as does the habit of spending, once it has been developed through self-discipline. And need I mention that it is a much more desirable habit?
When you speak of saving, you do not mean the mere hoarding of money in a savings account or a safety deposit box, do you, Mr. Carnegie?
No, I do not mean that. Intelligent saving calls for the use of one's savings. Money should be put to work earning more money. And if it is not put to use, one might as well not have any more than enough for actual living expenses.
What percentage of a man's income should be set aside as a savings fund?
That depends upon many things. The percentage should vary depending on dependent upon him for a living or an education. A single man should save a much larger percentage of his income than a married man, since, generally speaking, he has fewer dependents. He should save in anticipation of the day when he will have a family, as well as to provide himself with economic security in old age. But every man should save a definite percentage of his gross income, even if it is no more than 5%, in order that he may develop the habit of saving. The amount actually saved is not as important as the habit itself, because the savings habit connotes discipline with self-caning or of becoming much of discipline of a high order.
What do you see the most important item on a man's saving plan?
Life insurance. That should take precedence over everything else, whether a man is married or single. In the first place, life insurance forces one to adopt the savings habit, because the premiums have to be paid annually. And this is a form of savings which one cannot draw out and spend as easily. It is also a great builder of self-reliance, and it provides one with peace of mind and freedom from worry over what may happen to his dependents if he dies, or to himself in old age.
Clue. Make Health a Habit. Chapter 16.
The physical body is a house which the Creator provided to serve as a dwelling place for the mind. It is the most perfect mechanism ever produced, and it is practically self-maintaining. It has a brain which serves as the center of the nervous system, the coordinator of all bodily activity. Brain is the commander of all voluntary movements of the body, the controller of all involuntary movements carried on through the subconscious section, such as breathing, the heartbeat, digestion, circulation of the blood, distribution of nervous energy, and the like. The interpreter of the influences of environment and thought. It is the most powerful and the least understood organ of the body. The brain is the housing place of the subconscious section of the mind as well as of the conscious section. But the energy and the intelligence with which thought is produced flow into the brain from the great universal storehouse of infinite intelligence, the brain serving only as a receiver and as a distributor of this energy. Among its other duties, the brain operates a first-class department of chemistry, through which it breaks up and assimilates the food taken into the stomach, liquefies the food, and distributes it through the bloodstream to every part of the body where it is needed for maintenance and repair of the individual cells. All of this service is performed automatically, but there are certain simple aids which the individual can give the brain that will help it to maintain sound physical health. The burden of this chapter is that of describing these aids, viz. 1. Mental attitude. Inasmuch as the brain is the unchallenged boss of the entire physical body, we should recognize at the outset that sound physical health demands a positive mental attitude. Sound health begins with a sound health consciousness, just as financial success begins with a prosperity consciousness. And let it be here emphasized that no one ever succeeds financially without that prosperity consciousness, nor does one enjoy sound physical health without a health consciousness. Ponder this statement, for it conveys a truth that is of paramount benefit in the maintenance of sound physical health. To maintain a health consciousness, one must think in terms of sound health, not in terms of illness and disease, for we must emphasize that whatever the mind dwells upon, the mind brings into existence, whether it be financial success or physical health. Émile Coué, the French psychologist, gave the world, in one sentence, a very simple but practical formula for the maintenance of a health consciousness. Day by day, in every way, I am getting better and better. He recommended that this sentence be repeated thousands of times daily until the subject it on the circuit and discuss the road toward this. And here's an instance of sound health negative cell of the body. Cells are body services, a particle of food that is a steady evidence that found nurses her fear milk. And again, it is well known that any form of worry, fear, anger, jealousy, or hatred that one may experience while eating will cause the food to ferment in the stomach without assimilating, and indigestion is the natural result. To maintain a positive mental attitude suitable for the development and maintenance of a sound health consciousness, the mind must be free of negative thoughts and influences through self-discipline and established habits. There must be no crabbing or fault-finding that hurts the digestive organs. There must be no sustained hatred, for hatred attracts reprisals in kind and upsets digestion. There must be no fear. It indicates friction in human relationships, lack of harmony and understanding within one's mind, and discourages digestion. There must be no talk about illness and disease, for that leads to the development of the worst of all diseases, a disease known to the doctors as hypochondria, which means, in the language of the layman, imaginary illness. It has been established that 3/4 of all patients who visit doctors' offices for treatment are suffering with nothing more than imaginary illnesses. 2. Eating habits. This subject is worthy of an entire book, but inasmuch as there are many well-written books on the subject, we shall here confine ourselves to a few simple recommendations, which are on the must list for all who would enjoy sound health. The musts of correct eating. A. First, there must be no overeating. It affects heart, liver, kidneys, and the sewer system. A simple way to observe this admonition is the habit of getting up from the table before one is thoroughly satisfied. The habit will be a little difficult to acquire, but once it has been developed, it will pay off in big dividends, consisting in many benefits, among them a great saving in doctor's bills. Overeating is a form of intemperance, which may be, and it often is, just as injurious as intemperance in drinking alcoholic beverages or in the taking of narcotics. B. One must eat a balanced ration, consisting of at least a fair proportion of fruits and vegetables, because these contain the 16 major mineral elements which nature requires in the building and maintenance of the physical body. No vegetable contains all of these elements. Therefore, in order to provide the body with the building material it requires, one must eat a variety of food that is produced by nature from the soil of the earth. Moreover, one must be sure that the vegetables he eats contain all the mineral elements that nature demands, which is something I will a little be like not food by the until a rich this deficiency in. Of course, they move slow to Tampa, Florida, who is probably the ablest scientist in the field of soil feeding, has made astounding discoveries concerning the production of food. Through the application of colloidal chemistry, Dr. Northern has compounded a fertilizer which contains all the mineral elements needed by the soil for the production of healthful fruits and vegetables. He first analyzes the soil that is to be fertilized, discovers which minerals are lacking, then compounds a fertilizer containing those minerals. As a demonstration of his ideas, he planted two rows of bunch beans, 50 feet in length, side by side in the same soil. One row he fertilized with a compound containing all the necessary minerals for the production of healthful beans. The other row contained no fertilizer. The row that had been properly fertilized grew perfect beans which were not molested by bugs or insects, while the other row was literally eaten down to the stem of the beans by bugs and beetles. He discovered by his experiments that fruits and vegetables containing all of the minerals which nature intended them to contain developed within them a perfect immunity against attacks by insects. Moreover, he reasoned that the physical body which is supplied food containing all that nature requires for the maintenance of sound physical health will likewise repel disease germs and everything else that is deleterious to health. What a different system is Dr. Northern's scientific soil feeding from that of the average farmer who, if he fertilizes his soil at all, merely goes down to the retail fertilizer dealer and orders whatever the dealer may have on hand, not knowing whether or not it contains the mineral elements his soil lacks. Healthful food must be grown to order from soil that has been analyzed and is known to contain all the mineral elements which nature needs in the production of healthful food. Food that is lacking in the necessary mineral elements ferments in the alimentary canal, decays, and sets up a condition known as toxic poisoning. Thus, deficient food not only fails to supply the body with the mineral elements it needs to carry on its maintenance work, but it actually creates a poison, which may provide the beginning of a great variety of diseases. Some doctors have frankly admitted that most diseases begin in the alimentary canal because of improper digestion. C. There must be no gulping of food or fast eating. Such methods prevent the proper mastication of the food and also indicate a nervous mental attitude, which becomes a part of the food and is carried into the bloodstream. D. There must be no eating between meals of tidbits, such as candy bars and other sweets. If any eating between meals is done, it should consist of ripe fruits, berries, or raw vegetables. The better plan is to avoid between meal eating altogether. E. Liquor and other alcoholic beverages are on the taboo list at all times. F. Where properly mineralized fresh vegetables are not available, the deficiency should be made up by compounded vitamins. These are available in most drugstores, but they should never be taken without a complete physical analysis by a competent doctor, which will show how many vitamins are required and of what types. Vitamins contain the health-building factors of vegetation. They are the élan vital of all vegetation, the life-giving force. There is perhaps not one person in the United States who does not require at one time or another compounded vitamins of one combination or another to complete his or her dietary requirements. The wonders the vitamins perform in health building are many. Vitamin A dissolves kidney stones. Vitamin B1 aids the deaf. Vitamin G softens cataracts. Vitamin C helps to master hay fever and relieves arthritis. The story of the discovery and use of vitamins reads like the story of Alice in Wonderland. But the best of all sources of vitamins is in their natural state, as they exist in properly mineralized fruits and vegetables. Here they exist, just as nature intended them, for the benefit of living creatures. Victor Lindlar, in his book, You Are What You Eat, describes a wide variety of fruits, berries, and vegetables, with tables giving the vitamin content of each. G. Last, but by no means least, the mind must be conditioned and prepared for eating. One should never eat while angry, or frightened, or worried. Conversation while eating should be of a pleasant nature and not too intense. Family disagreements and discipline should never take place during mealtime. Eating should be a definite form of worship in which all negative states of mind have been discarded. It should be an expression of gratitude to the Creator for having prepared so great an abundance of the necessities of life for every living creature. Not an hour for ugly expressions and negative thinking. 3. Relaxation. Relaxation means the complete letting go of both the body and the mind, and particularly the clearing of the mind of all worries, fears, and anxieties. There should be a period of not less than 1 hour in each day during which the body and the mind are habitually relaxed and released from all voluntary effort. Relaxation for sound health requires an average of 8 hours a day for sleep. During sleep, the subconscious section of the mind goes to work in earnest, repairing and rebuilding the worn-out cells and tuning up the whole body in a general way. One's sleeping time cannot be dissipated or drawn upon for other purposes for any great length of time without serious damage to the physical body. It is during sleep that the body, by some mysterious method unknown to science, builds up and replenishes its store of bodily resistance, that miraculous energy which keeps disease germs in check and influences the billions of physical cells to do their work. At least 1 hour daily should be devoted to some hobby or play, preferably in the open air and the sunshine, to break the rhythm of one's daily routine. Here, as at mealtime, the mental attitude should be positive, optimistic, and pleasant. A game of golf or tennis or volleyball will work wonders for the person whose mind and body are engaged intensely by the demands of his daily occupation. 4. Elimination. There are four sources of elimination of the waste matter of the body. They are 1. The lungs, 2. The skin, 3. The kidneys, and 4. The general sewer system, known as the alimentary canal. These must be kept in first-class working condition at all times, and to make sure that they are in proper condition, one should have a complete checkup by a competent doctor at least once every 3 months. Of these four sources of elimination, the one that gives the greatest amount of trouble is the sewer system. The entire sewer system should be cleansed at least once a week. The sewer system should be completely detoxified at least once every 30 days. Many doctors are prepared to give detoxifications, which consist of a complete cleansing of the entire alimentary canal with the aid of pure water. These are not to be confused with the enema or the colonic irrigation, since detoxifications are much more thorough. Toxic poisoning is almost a national tradition with the American people, due in the main, as we have stated, to the fact that they do not get the right kind of minerals in their food. Those who live in cities and whose occupations are of a sedentary nature, where they get but little physical exercise, are almost universally the victims of toxic poisoning. Toxic poisoning and good dispositions are never found together. Toxic poisoning and positive mental attitudes are never found together. Remember this when that dull headache begins to put you on notice that your sewer system needs attention. Remember it also when your tongue is heavily coated in the morning and your disposition is one of irritability. Toxic poisoning kills off enthusiasm. It undermines the faculty of the imagination, and it leads to hopelessness and despair. It also destroys ambition and personal initiative, the two qualities which must precede all personal achievements. And it provides a favorable spawning place for almost every known physical ailment and disease. There are danger signals that announce the presence of toxic poisoning, the chief of them being the appearance of a dull headache, followed by the loss of appetite. The headache is a great blessing. It is nature's language by which she telegraphs to the brain for assistance, but too often the assistance comes, if at all, in the form of a drug which does nothing but cut the line of communication over which the headache is crying out for help. What the headache really needs is enough plain water to cleanse the entire sewer system. And the evidence that this is true consists in the fact that the headache usually disappears within 30 minutes after the sewer system has been cleansed. 5. Hope. The person who is without hope is temporarily lost. Sound health inspires hope, and hope inspires sound health, either way one chooses to look at the matter. Hope is inspired by a definite major purpose. It is the natural offspring of the person who is going somewhere in life, knows where he is going, has a plan for getting there, and is busy carrying out that plan. And the man who is filled with the hope of achievement of his major purpose is so happy that he has no place in his mind for fear and worry and doubt. But make no mistake about this. Hope and toxic poisoning never fraternize. Where one is found, the other will be absent. 6. Avoid the habit of drugs. The first thing one should do, preparatory to the development of a sound health consciousness, is to clean out the medicine chest and throw the entire contents down the sewer. Sound health does not come in bottles. Nature provided man with a very good system of health maintenance long before bottles or drugs were invented. Nature uses medicine for the maintenance of sound health, but she stores it in vegetables and fruits, in the natural state, in the form of more than 40 minerals, the more important of which are calcium, iron, and phosphorus. All of these minerals can be taken in their form of prepared pills and liquid medicines, but they serve nature's purpose much better if they are taken in their natural form, from food that grows from the soil. Moreover, nature has provided every person with an expert chemist who understands the exact proportion of each of these minerals that is needed for the maintenance of sound health. This is something which no individual can understand. Nature's chemist assimilates the food when it enters the stomach and the alimentary canal, reduces it to a liquid, and extracts from it the right combinations which are needed for health. All this provided the food is grown from properly prepared soil. Doctors have learned a great deal about the anatomy of the physical body. They have learned much about the maintenance of sound health, but they have not yet learned how to correct the causes of disease as expertly as nature does the job. No doctor ever cures any disease. When a cure is effected, it is nature that does the curing. The most that any doctor can do is to cooperate with nature, and some of the best doctors do this without the use of drugs. They are philosophers because they take into consideration both the causes and the effects of all forms of illness, and direct their attention mainly to the correction of the causes. Some of the drug doctors specialize in dealing with the effects of disease, and often prescribe sedatives, which only serve to deaden the pain temporarily. Physical pain is nature's universal language, in which she speaks effectively to every living creature on earth. Pain is nature's way of putting an individual on notice that some portion of his body needs attention, and the person who tries to kill pain without endeavoring to determine and correct its cause thereby offers effrontery to man and insult to the Creator. It is the cause of the pain that should be removed. There are times when one needs professional counsel from a doctor, but it is better to get it before one becomes ill than afterward, for here, as in most circumstances, an ounce of prevention is worth a ton of cure. Find out how your body functions. Study the combinations of food that your particular system and working habits require. Acquire moderation in your eating habits. Use self-discipline in all your habits. Thus you will express your highest form of gratitude toward your Creator. Everyone has been provided with a personal doctor functioning within his own body and skilled in the maintenance of sound health.
Benefit from Cosmic Habit Force. Chapter 17.
Before describing the law of cosmic habit force in detail, you may be interested in knowing what benefits it offers those who adapt themselves to it. First of all, you should know that this law is the climax of the entire philosophy of individual achievement. To get a slight degree of understanding of the importance of this law, consider that fact that is the master key to the principles previously described, and its benefits are available only to those who master and apply the instructions in previous chapters. In order that you may approach the study of this chapter with a favorable mental attitude, you should be informed at the outset of the promise it offers those who learn how to adapt themselves to the working principle which it presents. Understanding an application of the law can release you from fears and self-imposed limitations, thus enabling you to take full possession of your own mind. If it offered no further promise, this would be sufficient to justify all the time you may devote to its study. It can help you attain economic freedom for life, provided you follow the instructions in the previous chapters. It can aid you in eliminating the opposition of others in all your relationships, thus enabling you to negotiate your way through life with a minimum of friction. It can help you master most, if not all, of the major causes of physical conditions that cause illness and disease. It can clear your mind of negative conditions, thus paving the way for that state of mind known as faith. Cosmic habit force is the particular application of energy with which nature maintains the existing relationship between the atoms of matter, the stars and planets, the seasons of the year, night and day, sickness and health, life and death, and more important to us right now, it is the medium through which all habits and all human relationships are maintained, the medium through which thought is translated into its physical equivalent. You, of course, know that nature maintains a perfect balance between all the elements of matter and energy throughout the universe. You can see the stars and planets move with perfect precision, each keeping its own place in time and space year in and year out. You can see the seasons of the year come and go with perfect regularity. You can see that night and day follow each other in unending regularity. You can see that an oak tree grows from an acorn, and a pine tree grows from the seed of its ancestor. An acorn never produces a pine, nor does a pine cone ever produce an oak. And nothing is ever produced that does not have its antecedents in something else which preceded it. These are simple facts that anyone can see, but what most people cannot see or understand is the universal law through which nature maintains perfect balance between all matter and energy throughout the universe, forcing every living thing to reproduce itself. A fragmentary glimpse of this great law of nature, which holds our little earth in its proper position and causes all material objects to be attracted toward the center of the earth, was caught when Newton discovered what he called the law of gravitation. If Newton had gone a few steps beyond where he stopped, perhaps he would have discovered that the same law which holds our little earth in space and relates it to all the other planets in both time and space relates human beings to one another in exact conformity with the nature of their own thoughts. He would have discovered that the same force which draws all material things toward the center of the earth also builds men's thought habits in varying degrees of permanency. He would have discovered that negative thought habits, of whatever nature, attract to their creator physical manifestations corresponding to their nature, as perfectly as nature germinates the seed of the acorn and develops it into an oak tree. Also, he would have discovered that positive thoughts reach out through the self-same law and attract physical counterparts of their nature. You are here concerned only with the method by which nature takes a hold on the mind through the operation of the law. Before going any further, here is a brief description of an important function of cosmic habit force through which it controls all human relationships and determines whether an individual will be a success or a failure in his chosen occupation. Nature uses this law as a medium by which every living thing is forced to take on and become a part of the environment in which it lives and moves daily. We are all ruled by habit, all of us. Our habits are fastened upon us by repetition of thought and experience. Therefore, we can control our earthly destinies just to the extent that we control our thoughts. It is a profoundly significant fact that over the power of thought, a person may have complete control. Everything else is subject to forces outside of one's control. Nature has given man the privilege of controlling his thoughts, but she has also subjected him to the power of cosmic habit force, through which his thoughts are made to clothe themselves in their physical likeness and equivalent. If a man's dominating thoughts are of poverty, the law translates those thoughts into physical terms of misery and want. If a man's dominating thoughts are of opulence, the law transforms them into their physical counterpart. Man builds the pattern through his thoughts, but cosmic habit force works that pattern into its physical likeness and builds it into permanency. But how can a law of nature make something out of nothing? Some will ask. It is but natural that any practical person would want to know the exact manner in which, for example, cosmic habit force could transmute thoughts of opulence into material riches, or thoughts of poverty into material evidences of poverty. We are happy to raise the question and to answer it. To begin with, let us recognize the fact that cosmic habit force is silent, unseen, and unfelt, and works in complete harmony with all of nature's other forces, such as gravitation, electricity, evolution, etc. But it differs from all other natural forces in that it is the sole source of their power and serves as nature's comptroller, through which every form of power and every law of nature must work. It is the master key to the universe, so great in power that it controls every living thing and every atom of matter, the control being carried out through established habit force. The method by which cosmic habit force converts a positive impulse or mental desire into its physical equivalent is simple. It merely intensifies the desire into a state of mind known as faith, which inspires one to create definite plans for the attainment of whatever is desired, the plans being carried out through whatever natural methods the resourcefulness of the individual can command. Cosmic habit force does not undertake to transmute the desires for money directly into bank balances or specie, but it does set into motion the mechanism of imagination through which the most easily available means of converting the desire into money is provided in the form of a definite idea, plan, or method of procedure. This force works no miracles, makes no attempt to create something out of nothing, but it does help an individual, nay, it forces him, to proceed naturally and logically to convert his thoughts into their physical equivalent by using all the natural media available to him which may serve his purpose. The force works so quietly that the individual, unless he is of a philosophical trend of mind, does not recognize its relationship to what is happening to him. On one occasion, an idea will present itself to his mind in a form which he calls a hunch, and it will inspire him with such definite faith that he will begin at once to act upon it. His entire being has been changed from a negative to a positive state of mind, with the result that related ideas flow into his mind more freely, the plans he creates are more definite, and his words have more influence with other people. Because he does not understand the source from which his hunch came, he may dismiss the matter and imagine the newly discovered idea or plan with which he achieved success was the creation of his own brain. The hunch is simply a desire that has been given the intensity to enable cosmic habit force to take it over and give it the necessary momentum to convert it into a definite idea or plan of action. From that point on, the individual must move on his own by using such opportunities, human relationships, and physical conveniences as may be available to him for carrying out his desire. At times, one is inspired with awe by the coincidental combination of favorable circumstances with which he is favored in carrying out his plans, such as voluntary cooperation from unexpected sources, some fortunate transaction in business that provided unexpected money, etc., But always these strange and unexplained things happen through perfectly natural procedure similar to daily experiences. What the individual cannot see or understand is the method by which cosmic habit force gives to one's thoughts that peculiar quality which gives them the power to surmount all difficulties, overcome all resistances, and achieve seemingly unattainable ends through simple but natural procedure. That is one secret of nature which she has not yet revealed, but neither has she revealed the secret by which she causes a seed of wheat to germinate, grow, and reproduce itself, bringing back with it 100 additional grains for good measure. The mystery by which nature forces a grain of wheat to reproduce itself is no greater than that by which an individual like Henry Ford can start at scratch, with no working capital and no tools, and convert one simple desire into a huge industrial empire. But the two mysteries have one thing definitely in common. They move in response to the law of cosmic habit force, working on and with the thoughts of man and inherent life in a grain of wheat. Cosmic habit force guided me through an awe-inspiring maze of experiences before revealing itself to me. All through those years of struggle, there was one definite purpose uppermost in my mind, the burning desire to organize a philosophy with which the average man can become self-determining. Nature had no alternative but that of yielding to me the working principle of cosmic habit force, because I unwittingly complied with the law of persistently seeking the way to its discovery. If I had known of the existence of the law and of its working principle at the beginning of my research, I could have organized the philosophy of American achievement in a much shorter period of time. It is profoundly significant that the law of cosmic habit force was revealed after a daily contact of minds through the mastermind principle, covering a period of almost 2 years. A major portion of this time was devoted to the analysis of problems, which had nothing to do with a voluntary search for the law. But the important thing I wish here to emphasize is the fact that our habit of bringing our minds into rapport for a definite purpose daily actually had the effect of giving us the benefit of cosmic habit force before we knew of the existence of the law. Prior to the discovery of this force, we had not understood clearly what happens when two or more people bring their minds into rapport and apply the mastermind principle for the attainment of definite ends. We know that this form of harmonious cooperation brought results, but we did not know how or why our minds were so stimulated during a mastermind meeting that our thoughts took on an entirely different and more vital quality. We had observed, prior to discovery of cosmic habit force, that when we went into a mastermind meeting for the purpose of solving some problem, we had little difficulty in supplanting fear with faith. Moreover, the mere contacting of our minds for a definite purpose invariably caused a change to take place in our minds, which automatically transformed our fears and doubts into confidence and faith. We understand now that the best of all known ways of adapting oneself to the positive influence of cosmic habit force is provided through the mastermind principle, where two or more minds are coordinated in a spirit of perfect harmony for the attainment of a definite purpose. We know that his procedure has the effect of clearing the way for cosmic habit force to act directly upon the thoughts associated with the object of the meeting. We know also something of the manner in which this force operates in carrying out the purpose of the meeting. In the first place, the harmonious contact of two or more minds for a definite purpose fixes the object of the purpose in each mind with greater clarity. This modifies the thoughts of each party to the meeting in such a manner that all doubts and fears associated with the object of the meeting are converted into confidence and faith. It is a fact that where any family group or any group of business associates sits down together in a spirit of friendliness for the purpose of analyzing any problem they wish to solve, the mere discussion of the problem generally leads to its solution. When the solution comes, it generally comes in the form of a plan or a hunch that suddenly presents itself in the mind of one of the group. Many of these statements concerning the nature of cosmic habit force are abstract, but presently I shall proceed to reduce them to the concrete by describing exactly how this force operates in the daily affairs of men. I've shown you exactly how it is the determining factor which leads one to success and plenty, or to poverty and misery, how it brings harmony and understanding in marriage, or converts that relationship into disappointment and failure. I realize that merely to say that it is the force with which nature keeps the stars and planets in their place is not enough to be of benefit to the average man who is more concerned with the solution of his daily problems than with electrons, stars, and planets. I realize that the whole world has passed through economic collapses which have not only reduced millions of people to poverty and want, but have tried their very souls as well. And these millions of people who were fighting for the right to live their lives in peace and harmony wanted all the knowledge they could get that would help them. Because you may be faced with a similar situation in your lifetime, I shall describe in the simplest terms possible the most astounding conclusions of my 40 years of research into the causes of success and failure. I wish you to have a bird's-eye view of the relationship between cosmic habit force and three other important principles through which it becomes the most important factor in the lives of men. Two of these principles are associated with the method by which the force operates, and the third is the major principle by which the power of the force can be redirected and converted from positive to negative use by an individual. These four important associated principles are A. Cosmic habit force. The principle through which nature forces everyone to take on and become a part of the environmental influences which control his thinking. B. Drifting. The habit of mental indifference through which an individual allows chance and circumstances to fasten his environmental influences on him. C. Time. The factor with which cosmic habit force weaves together man's dominating thoughts and the influences of his environment and transforms them into stumbling blocks or stepping stones according to their nature. D. Definiteness of purpose, the only medium under control of an individual with which cosmic habit force may be controlled. In the statements to follow, you will observe how every success is the result of day by day and growing everyone's to serve half to during everyone's in focus is the best being on the side being positive or power that keeps ever flowing half serve that fail on you and further the knowledge or upseed forever deprive you of the results or failure. I warn you too that you will never again be privy to that, for you'll know definitely long you have the woman and potential power with which to change the circumstance of your life, whatever you fist you truth deep unadditionable force of father that you think presently I'm because I was you no matter who you are so answer like you. Run a to this can cut more common telks you just worlds late to time death you be serving ill health which you might and then ill can be me ear your love with it cakes that open fear and make nothing you earn the ever's equivalent damage. You want any room for doubt that every experience of yours depends on how you react to your command. You to limit those which are, but important know your mind can move all limitations establish it. You remember your fears and you're all the learned nature method I use grab it and start on the native for he forces the body. You think there's a lot of love and war to know your bond and to lead the same level of later to come and differ. Don't you try to explain what other people are. I know because even the dramatic that habit or carries them swiftly along the hell to fans permits their day. Income's stress has them for toughness. Time and make happen needs all become into jail. It has the eight stars in it in clubbering. Dating the way I've seen. How so early your many years to before understanding is just where you are because you're acted to do the smooth person you're for you. And are you always have ear or did not let you if you or help force you to drift on circumstances. Leaving the red winds that causes you. Within for a definite print. Rich reacts something above an emergent. Man's in the athlete. I'm prepared to ask that be. Not in for the pun showings. It was as paper of some important. Gum pencils. This power is like his principles. Cosmic hat for. When any useful are able to by my urge and personal experience. Conscious. Mean by this that those who have made successful application of the law have done so by mere chance without recognizing the real source of the power back of their achievements. Now that the law has been isolated and the principle of its operation understood, the fundamental principles of achievements will be treated for their exact value. They will be used as stimuli with which any desired habit may be begun and carried on voluntarily until cosmic habit force picks up the habit and automatically carries it to its logical climax. Observe the importance of the element of time as an essential factor with which the principles of achievement and cosmic habit force become related. Cosmic habit force is so inexorable that it automatically takes over habits and makes them permanent. It is the medium by which the habit of illness, known to physicians as hypochondria, suffering from imaginary illness, begins to grow from the very first moment one complains of illness or admits the presence of pain. If cosmic habit force will, and it most certainly does, crystallize an impulse of thought of illness and pain into a habit, think how much more quickly it will translate into permanency such pleasant sensations as intoxication through liquor, opiates, and sex emotion. Then, push your imagination just one step further, and you will quickly recognize what happens when these habits are so presented through clever advertising that the mind of the victim is continuously bombarded with the thought that they are signs of smartness. Then the forces of advertising become a voluntary and effective ally of the law of cosmic habit force, thus ensuring the fixation of the habits in less than one-tenth of the time nature would require if cosmic habit force were the only medium of fixation. When nature has a message to convey to mankind, she does not release it to those who are indulging in dissipation, nor does she hand it over to those who have been pampered and protected from struggle, but she picks as her torchbearers those who have been seasoned by defeat until they have become self-determining. I could not imagine a WPA worker or a CCC boy becoming an Edison or a Ford. Genius is born of hardship, of deprivation, and of toil to surmount difficulties, and not of subsidy. Chapter 18. Keep the Source of All Wealth. You now have a workable understanding of the master key to all riches. It is only natural that you may wish to use the key to unlock the door to material riches. Let us turn, then, to the analysis of the great American system of free enterprise, because this is the major source of material riches. It is also the source from which most of our economic leaders have been developed. Our system of free enterprise is not a quick-growth institution, but it is the product of many decades of evolution during which it has been supported and developed by scientific research as well as by the trial-and-error method of gathering useful knowledge. Its birth, development, and growth have not been without errors and mistakes, some of which were the result of avarice and greed upon the part of a few who sought quick riches, but most of which were the honest mistakes of men who sincerely sought the way to perfection by the best means that were available through the trial-and-error method. Whatever the mistakes of the leaders of our system of free enterprise may have been, whether they were honest or dishonest mistakes, the system stands today as one of the greatest wonders of the industrial world. This was proved, beyond all reasonable room for doubt, by the astounding job that industry did in providing the necessary materials for the conduct of World War II. The American system of industry is the envy of the world due to the fact that it is manned by leaders and workers who coordinate their efforts in a manner which has developed a high degree of industrial economy. But there is another reason for its efficiency, and it dates back to the founding of our nation and has its roots in the Constitution, which was so written as to provide incentive for the exercise of individual initiative and the right to the benefits of free enterprise, popularly known as the profit motive. This is the central core of our American industrial efficiency. It is efficient because the men who run it, the men who own it, and the men who work in it, from the management on down to the humblest worker, all desire to make a profit. No one ever does anything voluntarily without a motive. The motive for desire for financial gain is one of the three most impelling motives for all mankind, the other two being the motive of love and the motive of sex. Now consider how wisely the authors of the Constitution wrote into that famous document a system of government which not only provides the humblest citizen with the right to exercise his own personal initiative under our system of free enterprise, but it consists also of a system of checks and balances which protects this right. It anticipates man's natural desire to govern himself by motives and deliberately provides encouragement for the individual to choose whatever motive he pleases, with the assurance that he will have the power of the government back of him in carrying out his purpose. Andrew Carnegie, who was recognized as the greatest industrial leader of his time, was so keenly aware of the stimulating effect of the profit motive that he deliberately encouraged his associate workers to make the most of this motive. Some of them began as ordinary laborers, but they so related themselves to their fellow workers under our system of free enterprise that they accumulated vast personal fortunes. It was one of these workers, who began as a stake driver at ordinary day wages, who promoted himself until he became the moving spirit in the organization of the great United States Steel Corporation, which has added hundreds of millions of dollars of wealth to the nation as a whole, to say nothing of having provided millions of jobs for men and women, directly and indirectly. His name was Charles M. Schwab. On some occasions, Mr. Schwab made such effective use of our system of free enterprise that he not only earned a salary greater than that of the President of the United States, but an additional bonus of as much as $1 million in a single year. An achievement that would have been impossible without the friendly cooperation of Mr. Carnegie and the benefits of our system of free enterprise. When Mr. Carnegie was asked if he could not have availed himself of Mr. Schwab's services without the payment of so huge a bonus, he replied, "Oh yes, I could have had his services for less, but I am in business to make men as well as to make money. And I have learned that the best way to develop men is to provide them with an incentive to do their best. I have found no incentive which beats that of desire for financial gain." So here is a clear statement by the greatest industrialist this country has ever known, which lays the finger squarely on one of the major advantages of our system of free enterprise. It is a system which develops personal initiative and thereby helps men to do their best, to do it willingly and voluntarily. This point is emphasized because it turns the spotlight on the greatest of all the assets of the richest and the freest nation. And that is the ingenious manner in which the American form of government and the American system of free enterprise have been so coordinated that they inspire and encourage every citizen to do his best. Take away from a man the right to make a profit on his services and limit his right to exercise his personal initiative in whatever direction he chooses, and you will have destroyed the greatest asset that any man has, no matter what may be the pretense under which this is done. The desire to accumulate material riches stands near the head of the list of all human desires. It is as fundamental as the Creator could make it, as is evidenced by the fact that it is universal. We look at the records of such men as Andrew Carnegie, Henry Ford, and Thomas A. Edison, men who became eminently successful in the accumulation of material riches, and we marvel at their achievements, not suspecting perhaps that back of these achievements is a plan far more profound than that of the desire for riches. We seldom stop to wonder whether or not these achievements may be a part of the Creator's plan to urge men onward and upward in civilization's progress by planting in their minds a strong motive for the exercise of their personal initiative. But this much we do know. Our country has been blessed, more than the other countries of the world, with the privilege of providing the world with its first system of free enterprise. This system is so ingeniously arranged that it both inspires men to do their best and adequately provides them with a natural motive for doing so. Surely we are not so bankrupt in our power of thought that we cannot see that back of all these blessings of liberty and freedom and opportunity to accumulate personal wealth, there may be a purpose deeper than that of the mere desires of men. We sincerely believe it has been the lack of recognition of this divine purpose which has brought this and all other nations to the very brink of world disaster through spiritual bankruptcy. The Creator has ingenious methods of carrying out the overall plan of human progress, not the least of which is that by which man is influenced by natural motives to do his best. Take the motives of love and sex, for example, through a combination of which the Creator has provided a system which ensures the perpetuation of all human life. These motives have been made so alluring and powerful that it is not of man's choice to respond to them or reject them. The Creator has seen to it that life on this earth shall continue according to His plans, no matter what man may think he wants or to what motives he may attribute the results of his activities. Henry Ford may have believed that he was motivated by a desire for financial gain, or he may have believed that he was motivated by the pride of personal achievement through which he established a great industrial empire that benefited other people more than it benefited him. But one thing he may never have known, and it was not essential that he know it, is that through his efforts, millions of men and women are motivated to carry out the Creator's plans by the development of their minds through the exercise of their personal initiative. The human brain develops only through personal initiative. This is a fact well known to every psychologist, but not everyone recognizes the possibility that back of all expression of personal initiative is the Creator's plan to ensure man's mental and spiritual growth through his own endeavors. The whole of nature and the recognized methods by which all natural laws operate provide inescapable evidence of the soundness of this theory. And recognition of this evidence will remove all odium with which our system of free enterprise has been besmirched by those who would find fault with it without offering the world a better system. Able thinkers have agreed that it was no mere stroke of chance that has provided the people of this country with unparalleled privileges and opportunities to develop and grow through the expression of their personal initiative. This privilege outweighs every other privilege we enjoy, for it provides everyone with the opportunity to choose his own motive and to live his own life and accumulate riches in whatever form and quantity he may desire. Andrew Carnegie recognized that the American people might become over-engrossed in the accumulation of material riches because he knew, as we all know, that there is such an overabundance of wealth and opportunity to accumulate wealth in the United States, that there is a danger men may evaluate too lightly that which comes too easily. He could see the tendency of people to mistake their privileges of opportunity for a license to expect and demand something for nothing, a tendency which now stands out definitely as the greatest danger of our times. It was Mr. Carnegie's recognition of this danger which influenced him to devise an ingenious plan for the distribution of the greater portion of his personal wealth, so that it would influence men to become seekers after knowledge. And it was his recognition of this danger that inspired him to influence more than 500 of the leaders of industry to collaborate in the organization of the 17 principles of the philosophy of individual achievement described in previous chapters. He well knew that material riches accumulated by a strict application of these 17 principles could have no other effect than that of enriching the nation as a whole, as well as enriching the individuals who accumulated the riches. Thus it is clear that Mr. Carnegie understood the benefits of sharing, for he obviously recognized the truth that men are only the temporary custodians of material riches, that riches are a blessing when they are so regarded and so used that they provide opportunities for all men to participate in their use. God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. Who among us is so blind as not to see that there is something more profound than the mere desire for personal riches, which has made our country the richest and the freest nation of the world? And who would be so unwise or so blind as to deny that such men as Andrew Carnegie, Henry Ford, and Thomas A. Edison have made this a better country than it could have become without their efforts? These men who have added billions of dollars to our wealth and provide an outlet for the talents of tens of millions of men and women. And who is wise enough to say that the personal initiative of such men is not a part of the overall plan of an all-wise providence? The deeper thinker will be more apt to say that what we need is more men of this type, not fewer. That our great system of free enterprise, which provides opportunities for all men seeking an outlet for their talents, is a blessing of major proportions, not a curse. And the true wise individual will embrace our system of free enterprise, help to improve it when he can, and relate himself to it harmoniously, so it may carry him to the attainment of his personal ambitions. It was in this spirit that Henry Ford related himself to our system of free enterprise. And while he began without money, with very little schooling, and chose a field of endeavor in which he had to become a pioneer, with the trial and error method as his only guide, he attained results which astounded the entire industrial world. We know that he struggled tirelessly to perfect the automobile that was destined to make him the directing head of a great industrial empire, working late hours and using all of the talents he possessed. We know that out of his persistent use of his personal initiative came an industry which provides employment, directly or indirectly, for many millions of men and women whose combined wages amount to so many millions of dollars each working day. All of these facts we know, but what we do not know is the nature of the motive, the real hidden motive, which inspired Mr. Ford to carry on. We may say it was the profit motive, but there are many facts connected with his career which indicate that we shall have to go deeper than the profit motive for the real answer. Of one thing we may be sure, the American form of government and the American system of free enterprise provided aid and encouragement to Mr. Ford and gave him the hope and faith necessary to enable him to carry on through many years of struggle. We know also that out of that struggle came a great network of industrial plants, improved highways that covered the entire nation, gasoline filling stations, automobile garages and repair shops, automobile accessory stores, and other business enterprises which provide employment for millions of people. Perhaps Mr. Ford did not have all of these astounding results in mind while he was laboring to perfect his automobile. But whatever his motive may have been, the results were the same. Surely no one in his right mind would believe that Mr. Ford could have accomplished such stupendous results if in the beginning his personal initiative had been subdued, discouraged, or limited in any manner. On the other hand, it is obvious that he succeeded because he made intelligent application of the 17 principles of this philosophy, through which he related himself harmoniously to the great American system of free enterprise. If we combine the results attained by Henry Ford with those attained by the other great industrial leaders of the past several decades, we shall have what is known as the American way of life. There are many facts connected with the American system of free enterprise which require no great amount of analysis in order that we may recognize their benefits. The first of these is the fact that our industrial system provides the greatest source of inspiration for the use of personal initiative. In this respect, it is the same today as it was when Henry Ford, Andrew Carnegie, and Thomas A. Edison began their careers. The entire system is one that encourages men to do their best and appropriately rewards those who, by their superior skill, imagination, and personal initiative, render greater service, basing the reward on the quality and the quantity of the service rendered, plus the mental attitude in which it is rendered. Our system of free enterprise gives employment to most of the skilled labor and a large portion of the unskilled labor at wages not equaled in any other country or during any other period in the history of industry. This same system provides working conditions which are without parallel anywhere else or at any other time in the history of the world. It supplies the income that supports the major portion of all professional service, such as that rendered by lawyers, doctors, dentists, architects, and clergymen. It provides the money which pays for most of the surplus products of agriculture. Therefore, it is no exaggeration to say that it supports the farmers and pays the interest on the farm mortgages and provides a market for all farm products. It pays, directly and indirectly, most of the taxes which are necessary for the maintenance of both our state and federal governments. It is a partner of government, and as such, it deserves the protection of the government which was provided by the Constitution. It provides the machinery and the equipment and the working capital with which the inventor, such as Thomas A. Edison, may take the profits of his ingenuity to the people of the world at a profit. It has been responsible for the building of every improved highway and every automobile that travels over these highways, not to mention the stupendous increases in the value of the lands through which the highways have passed. It provides a ready market for the talents of every person who has a commercially sound idea to market in any field of useful endeavor. It builds every battleship, every commercial boat used in American shipping, and supplies all needed war materials used in the defense of our nation, which is to say that it is the strong arm of Uncle Sam's fighting forces, on both land and sea, as well as in the air. The American system of free enterprise and the American system of government are twin brothers, in fact, for they are inseparable parts of that which we call the American way of life. The American Constitution was written so as to give the fullest possible measure of protection to our industrial system, and that system has been developed through close coordination with our government. Therefore, any weakening of one weakens proportionately the other. If the American system of free enterprise were destroyed, our American form of government would go with it. The man who says it can't be done is usually busy trying to keep out of the way of the man who is doing it.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of How to Raise Your Own Salary by Napoleon Hill. Performed by Tom Parks, Dan John Miller, and Christopher Lane. Engineered by Patrick Murdoch. Performance copyright 2017 by Brilliance Publishing, Inc. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.